Welcome to a very special late night, recorded after midnight in the basement with beer edition of It's All Political and on San Francisco and Opinion Central. And this is Joe Garofoli, the Chronicle's senior political writer, and we're going to go around the table here with our all-star cast of the political team here at the Chronicle, and just so you know who's speaking when they're speaking. I'm Joe Garofoli, and to my left on your podcast dial is the big man. Go ahead.
John Wildermuth, political writer for The Chronicle.
John Diaz, editorial page editor.
Heather Knight, columnist.
Melody Gutierrez, Sacramento bureau chief.
I'm Audrey Cooper. I'm the editor-in-chief.
All right. So we're going to start with the federal races. There's a lot that we know, and there's a lot that we don't know right now. What we do know is that the House is in control of the Democrats. The Senate remains in control of the Republicans. And we know that there's a lot of House races in California that are literally, as our governor-elect says, separated by dozens of votes, hundreds of votes. Big man, give us out there.
Well, the Democrats are really, really happy that they had the 23-plus votes they needed to take over the House before California even finished voting. Because if they were depending on California, they'd be waiting days or weeks before they had those final numbers.
We will be waiting days and weeks before we know the winners in some of these races in Orange County, correct?
Well, in the state in general, because right now, I mean, there were seven seats the Democrats targeted, seven Republican-held seats. And in at least three of them, with 30 to 50% of the vote in, they're hundreds of votes separate the two candidates. And the other ones aren't that much different. So considering that people have told me there's expected to be 3 million or more uncounted ballots after tonight spread out through the state, this could be a long, long count.
Oh, yeah. What does it mean that now that President Trump, for the first two years of his pregnancy. Wow.
How much of that beer have you had so far? It is late.
For the first 2 years of his presidency, he had no check.
That was fake news.
He was not pregnant. He had the House in Republican control, Senate in Republican control, a strong majority on the Supreme Court. What's it going to mean now? How does he change doing the way he does business?
Well, what changes in Congress is once one party even controls by one vote, has one more vote than the other, every chairmanship is going to be controlled by that party. Suddenly the investigations committees are all, the Judiciary Committee in the House, all going to be controlled by Democrats. Adam Schiff, who had been the loyal opposition, if you will, for the past couple years, is now going to be chair. Devin Nunes, who knows what he's going to be doing now. They're going to have subpoena power. It's really going to change the dynamic. I think we're going to see oversight not only on the collusion and Russian investigation, but I suspect on all these things that are going on in some of these agencies with the Department of Interior, both policy and scandals. It's going to be a different world.
But is that a smart strategy for Democrats, is just an endless stream of investigations? Doesn't it kind of paint them as being against Trump and not for something else?
Well, if you listen to Nancy Pelosi when she spoke tonight, she made it clear. She said, well, you know, we'll compromise when we need to, and we'll stand our ground when we have to. But she made it real clear that they can't just be the party of no, that, you know, people want to get things done. They want to see... They don't want 2 years of people yelling at each other. And if the Democrats are going to do that, it's not going to turn out too well for them, probably in 2020.
And she and Trump did speak tonight on the phone, so maybe that's a signal that they will.
Can Trump and Pelosi cut a deal? There's their two alleged great deal makers. Pelosi certainly has a better track record at it. Is there hope for any kind of deal on anything?
I mean, Trump hasn't really proven that he can cut a deal with his own party, really. There haven't been a lot of policy wins. And from the deal maker president, I think if the Democrats were smart, they'd start pointing this out. So, you know, on one hand, Nancy Pelosi will have an unenviable task of trying to keep that majority, to try to not look like an obstructionist party. But on the other hand, if she can get a couple of things through, she starts looking like a rose. She's the one who can actually work with a president that a lot of people don't want to have anything to do with.
I think what you're going to see in a hurry is effort on an infrastructure bill, because that's something that both parties say we need it. We need to fix up the infrastructure of the country. And there's common ground there. And it depends on whether you can get the president to sign on, but at least it's an area where people don't automatically sit and say, you know, no.
And they've been talking about that infrastructure bill for 2 years, so it's strange that that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and also you have about a 6 month window to do it, because then everybody starts running for president, and that's going to be about,
they're already running for president.
Yeah, they're already, but like officially running for president, there'll be about two dozen of them.
You know, and the other thing that happens starting tomorrow is Pelosi wants those tax returns from the president, so they're going to have a few big swings outside of, you know, right off the bat, that are going to make this a very uncomfortable time in Washington for the president and the president's supporters. If he can see through that and get a deal done, he doesn't strike me as that kind of person. He seems kind of binary in who he likes to deal with. So we'll see if he changes tack. I think he'll have to if he really wants to have any wins when he's up for re-election.
Now, one thing you see is that Mitch McConnell in the Senate has a little more room to play now. He can lose on certain issues, or Rand Paul, or some of these other guys, and still get the numbers he wants. So he's got a little better position of strength in the Senate than he has right now.
The exit polls tonight said 41%, this is like the last time I looked at it, 41% identified health care as their top issue, 23% said immigration. What message does that send to both sides?
I mean, you certainly saw this leading up to the election. I mean, immigration was the push from President Trump over and over. There was a lot of talk of that. And so I'm not surprised that that was something that people were, you know, saying is on the top of their minds. And where that drove them on election day, I think, is the interesting thing, too.
Do you think the president made a mistake by talking up immigration to sort of, you know, the last ditch effort to get out the vote? I mean, his short term gain, he saved the Senate. And maybe
he didn't have anything else to talk about, though. That's the problem.
He could have talked about the economy. He could have talked about this. The economy is very strong. Unemployment's very low. He can talk about
this. But I think that's exactly why only 23% said immigration was number one. If you are unemployed, then that starts to go up a lot more. But if you're employed and you just see your healthcare premiums skyrocketing, or have a hard time, you know, with the legacy of Obamacare, then that's something that's very personal. But in a strong economy, I think immigration is a much more abstract worry.
Or maybe that the economy is only helping a certain layer of people, and it's not helping everyone.
I think immigration was a short-term loss for the president, particularly when you see, like, the Nevada Senate race has just been called for Jackie Rosen, the first pickup for the Democrats of the night, certainly a big Latino vote in Nevada. In Arizona, a seat held by Jeff Flake, a Republican, is right now neck and neck. I think that probably in the long run, in the short run, certainly did not help salvage things for the president. And I just can't help but think that this is corroding the Republican brand for the long term, as we saw in California with Pete Wilson in 1994.
Yeah, except what you also notice is that he did make sure that those Republican Senate seats stayed Republican. And I'm sure you're going to hear him tomorrow and after that saying, you know, I'm the guy that saved the Republican Party and saved everything like that. And you have to remember in Pete Wilson won that race. And it worked out real good for him. It didn't work out so well for the Republican Party in the future, though.
There was a night of firsts tonight. The first Muslim woman elected to Congress. First Native American women elected to Congress. The youngest woman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, was elected to Congress. She's, I think, 29. And so what makes us think that this the year of the woman is more than a one-off and it's a long-term trend? Do we think that this is just like something that's happened this year as a reaction to Trump in a midterm year? Do we see any signs that this could be long-lasting?
Well, more women were running than ever before. So you have a better chance if there are more of you running. And look, I always say, what is that terrible cliche, when the guys mess it up, they finally put the women in charge? That's what I think it's really about. I mean, it's not just the cheetah logger speaking either. I think that there is an interest in having candidates who are talking about real issues and who are talking to people and not having that affected politician. And women are doing that really effectively nationwide.
And not just yelling at each other, but actually talking about real policies and substance.
And remember, more than anything else, the hardest race for anybody to win is that first one. If you're in Congress and the fact that you've managed to get to your primary and then you win a seat in Congress, most people who have seats in Congress keep seats in Congress. So there's right now more than 100 women going to be in this new Congress, and most of them are Democrats. And a pretty good percentage of them are going to be reelected in 2 years. Hmm.
And then it was a mixed bag for candidates of color. Stacey Abrams is behind at this point in Georgia. She would have been the first African-American woman elected anywhere in America. That race has not been called, right? I don't think that's been called.
She hasn't conceded.
Andrew Gillum would have been the first black governor in Florida history. He lost. To Ron DeSantis, who's a former congressman, who's sort of a Trump clone, a protege. What did that tell us?
I think it tells you a couple of things. The first is the Democrats are still really bad at the black get out the vote. It was a problem for Hillary Clinton, and it continues to be a problem. You also cannot dismiss voter suppression efforts and the gerrymandering and the institutional problems that disaffected communities have, whether it's their polling place being too far away and them not having a car, or your provisional ballot being rejected because it's in the wrong ink. Whatever crazy reason, it is still happening in this country. And frankly, I think the national media has done a terrible job of covering that. And then I think you also have to question whether the Democrats on the, you know, the more liberal side of the spectrum, which a lot of these candidates of color were, whether that's resonating with voters. Do they want to go further left as the sort of pendulum swings away from Trump, or are they still looking for centrist candidates? I think the progressives say, no, you know, everybody's over centrism, populism is the way to go. Bernie Sanders proved that. I think this election has to show them that they aren't necessarily right about that.
We can throw Beto O'Rourke into that, too. Mm-hmm. It was a very unapologetic progressive running in a state that's, you know, hasn't elected a hell of a lot of Democrats in recent years in Texas, and he also lost to Ted Cruz, the most loathed man in the Senate.
But far closer than one would have expected, you know, just a few months ago. Yes. I mean, he certainly was strong, and I think we'll be hearing more of him.
Well, the other thing is that what you noticed is that these Democratic candidates in red-leaning states didn't lose too badly. But what they did do is they brought out Democrats to vote. There were two districts in Texas that were flipped. There were a couple districts in Florida that were flipped. And that might not have happened if you didn't have somebody at the top of the ticket bringing out the voters.
All right, let's take a look at the only city that matters, San Francisco, California. Heather, what did we learn in San Francisco tonight? Or the Prop C was, of course, the marquee thing on the ballot. Give us a quick explanation of what that was and where it's at. I just got back
from Acapulco in the Mission, which has very sticky floors. You cannot try to walk there very easily.
That's a good election party.
I would like her. Why aren't we there?
Yeah, why aren't we there?
So it did win pretty handily, got 60% of the vote. People were pretty excited. There were some big names out there celebrating: Mark Leno, former state senator, some supervisors, and the advocate crowd. But they did not achieve the two-thirds that they needed to avoid a lawsuit. So already the no on C side is saying, we're never going to see a penny of this money. And we will definitely see some fighting over it. Continue. So it's not the end of Prop C, but people are
so the tax
happy.
Is going to be collected, but yeah. Won't be able to be spent.
Right. So as we all know, court cases drag on forever. I've heard that they will start collecting the money, which is about $300 million a year, but they will probably sit on it just in case they don't want to spend it and then have to pay it all back. So by the time this court case is over, in 2 or 3 years even, they could have close to $1 billion to then just suddenly spend on homeless services. So
I don't see how you see Prop C and what has happened tonight as anything but a slap into the face of our new mayor. She came out against it. She got some of her buddies, State Senator Scott Wiener, Assemblyman David Chu, to come out against it at the same time. She thought she was in the clear, that she could say, you know, we just want to make sure that the money that we have is being spent well. And then Mark Benioff, the Salesforce CEO, comes out with his checkbook, and he wrote a lot of checks for Prop C. And more importantly, I think he was engaged on Twitter as a personality, calling out the other tech CEOs who really came across as being uninformed, unsympathetic, and sort of oblivious as to what real San Franciscans are feeling about this crisis on our streets. I think it's possible in San Francisco, if you have enough money, to avoid the crisis that we see on the streets. But that's not most of us who live in the city. And voters came out more than 60%, I think, in the latest round, in favor of this. The opponents want to see it as a defeat, but 60%, that's moving the dial in this town.
And it started as pretty unpopular. People really weren't paying attention to it over the summer. It was just kind of dismissed as this crazy coalition on homelessness thing that, you know, wasn't going to happen. But once Benioff got involved and Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi signed on and some big names came out in support, I think London Breed found herself, when you're all alone with Jack Dorsey, it's not a great place to be.
It's not a good place to be in this city.
But look at what the advertising for Prop C was. It said, look, we'll have all this money to spend on homelessness, and we're only going to take it from the real rich companies. You're not going to have to pay a nickel. So for most voters, it was free money.
Right.
And who wouldn't vote for free money?
But the no on C side was really confusing. They tried to say, we don't know where our money is being spent now, which is a strange thing for a mayor to say who's been in City Hall for many years. And then they said the programs that we have are failing, but then they've actually moved thousands of people inside. And then they said, no, the program's successful. We just need the current level of money that we already have. And so they just kept changing their reasoning. And I think voters saw through that.
There's no way you can see this as anything but a real problem moving forward for London Breed, because she has now a measure she didn't wanted. They're going to collect taxes that she didn't want to collect. They won't be able to spend any of the money. She didn't want it in the first place, and now the voters are going to put it on her to own cleaning this up. I don't know how she gets herself out of that mess right
now. And I think she's handed her potential opponent an issue in the 2019 campaign. I think from the beginning, the mistake that she made in coming out against it is not coming up with a plausible reason why not, a plausible alternative. Like, we need to do this, that, and the other thing before we have this infusion of $300 million. Because otherwise, she basically came out opposed to it and then went into the witness protection program.
Tonight she was at the party celebrating the passage of the seawall bond. Arguably the worst party in town. Well, you know, there's probably some money behind it. So nobody in the city hated the seawall bond. Everybody was for it. You could not have been to a more friendly party outside of the political fray. But seriously, where are these coattails? You know, if you're going to be mayor, you're going to have to own something. And instead of taking it up, like John said, she's given it to somebody else.
And there's no sweeter spot than now to do it. Unemployment 2%. She's a new mayor, still on a honeymoon. Why not do it now? Why didn't she do it now?
I think that was a politically bad move that is going to haunt her. She could have at least stayed neutral. But she didn't know Benioff was going to come out the other way 3 days after she did. So I've heard that she was pretty...
He's been very conciliatory to her, though. I mean, he's played it right down the middle. You know, Willie Brown, who's very close with London Breed, says, well, you know, this is very complicated and this is a human problem. But then on the other hand, Willie was saying, well, the Democrats need clear messaging. I'm like, wait, you can't say you need clear messaging and then on the biggest problem in the city, punt because it's too complicated to explain to people. That is not going to work anymore.
One of the most recent mailers from the No on C crowd had pictures of London, Willie, Gavin. Was there another mayor? There may have been. All saying no on Prop C but their argument didn't make sense. They're the ones who've been in charge of the money, and yet they're saying, we don't know where this money's being spent and everything's failing. Well, they're the ones who did it.
Was Newsom officially against Prop C, or he just kind of
he
like,
punted. Then he tried to claim he didn't even know what it was.
No,
yeah, which is the most ridiculous. Like, Gavin Newsom knows details of things. Yeah. He knew the details of that. He didn't come out against it, but he said, you know, we're going to attract more homeless people here, and it's not just San Francisco's problem. He definitely tried to play it both ways. And he's said that the state needs a statewide solution to homelessness. This is going to be on Gavin, too, if he wants to extend a national persona.
Or maybe now that he's a Marin County resident, he thinks homelessness has been solved.
Well, it was interesting. I was on the bus with Gavin, and he was asked a question about Prop C, and he said, well, you know, I'm going to be governor of the entire state, and if I just dealt with every single issue in every single county, I wouldn't have a
minute. Oh, the Jerry Brown response to homelessness.
I think that's hopeful for Californians who would like Gavin to be more like Jerry. Melody, that's like a Jerry answer, isn't it?
That's an absolute Jerry answer. I mean, that's it. I'm going to go ahead and look over here while you're talking to me and just completely ignore what you're saying.
Yeah, to claim that as the former mayor of San Francisco, whose number one priority was homelessness, to suddenly not care about San Francisco's major ballot measure on homelessness.
Well, he moved out of the city.
Did not fly.
He's just not there. What else? Anything else in San Francisco that we should
I wanted to note in another strike against London Breed, she doesn't seem to be doing too well on her candidates for supervisor either.
Yeah, so, it looks like they're going to be a progressive majority.
Yeah. We know that Matt Haney has won in District 6. She backed the other two candidates in the race and not him. And then the others are still shaking out with ranked choice voting, but it looks like Gordon Maher may have a shot out in the Sunset, which would also be a big blow to her. So she did not have a good night.
Ooh. Well, the Seawall thing passed, though, so at least the party was good.
She picked the right party.
Well, let's move on to the state. Melody, what do we learn from the state results tonight? What is the state of California going to look like tomorrow morning, or this morning, I guess?
I think we're going to be looking at the legislature and whether or not there is a supermajority in both houses. The Assembly, you know, very clearly they're going to hold on to their seats and possibly pick up a couple more. So they've got some cushion there in the Assembly. In the Senate, it was all coming down to whether or not they could pick up one more seat and have everybody retain their seats. And that right now is within, the last I checked, was within a couple hundred votes. I mean, those are really close Central Valley seats that it could go either way. And that'll be interesting with a new mayor coming in. I feel like that supermajority could go from being something that was considered, oh, it's nice to have and we'll use it when it's necessary, to really being able to throw things and ram things through.
Is that going to be Newsom's worst nightmare, though, to have a supermajority? Because are those guys going to want, like, they're going to want the store, right? Or what? How's that going to break down?
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to send him every bill that Democrats want. And there's going to be a lot of requests this time around. And I think he's going to be tested really early on where he's going to draw the line. And you're going to see a lot of Democrats, especially the first January budget, saying, you know, well, you know, we really need more. And with the surplus as it is, I think that first test is going to come really fast.
Who does he say no to? I mean, the SEIU has given him millions. The nurses have given him millions. The teachers have given him millions. Who's he gonna buckle to? Is he gonna say no to anybody?
I mean, that'll be the big question. I think with the Democrats coming in, there is obviously, like, even with the supermajority, you have the conservative group of moderate Democrats that are coming into the mods, and it's a growing caucus, and they have their own infighting even now. And so I think it'll be interesting to see, like, just how much you can actually get through when you have a growing moderate Democrat voice coming through. So maybe he won't have as much to deal with on his plate.
Well, that's, you know, one thing that is really easy to see is that just because you have a lot of Democrats there, a two-thirds majority, doesn't mean they all agree with each other.
Right.
And there are plenty of things where, you know, Jerry was pretty good at splitting some of this stuff and managing to work the Democrats against each other. Now, he had a lot more clout and a lot more experience than Gavin has. Gavin really doesn't have any relationships with the legislature at all.
Right.
And it's going to be something brand new for him and not an easy thing. Because, like Jerry found out, Republicans weren't going to be his problem. It's the Democrats.
Yeah, and the other thing is, Jerry is capable of going into his office and staying there for a little while. Mm-hmm. Gavin Newsom, with his victory speech tonight, came out swinging and announcing California as the new headquarters of the resistance, and he named himself, you know, executor in chief of that resistance movement. That speech was 80% aimed at one person, and he is sitting in the Oval Office tonight.
How many times did he use the word audacious?
Not even once, but what? I did say the word audacious. No. Yes.
By the way, you said a binary tonight, too.
I did say binary.
You said binary as our governor.
I've listened to Gavin a lot over the years. Yes,
you literally did not use it once.
Literally. Heather does the best literally.
Literally.
He's all with love.
Whatever.
Journalistic love.
He said tonight, in his the governor-elect said this, he doesn't want Trump to disrupt California with the politics of chaos. And he said, because in California, we don't demean, we don't discriminate, and we don't demoralize. We don't separate families, and we don't lock kids in cages. There's a reason why California's dream is America's leading brand. Because California's dream has always been and has always and always will be too big to fail and too powerful to bully.
So many quotable lines in the speech.
The
whole speech was a bunch of quotes, like just strung together in a way I've never seen before. It was incredible.
Yeah.
A lot of business references in there, too. Too big to fail.
Yes.
On the other hand, anything... anybody who's in charge of California somewhere along the line has to work with the federal government. I mean, matter of fact, that's one of the things that when he's talking about his single-payer health plan, that can't get done or anything like that getting done without a whole lot of federal where they just
waivers,
go and
they waivers all over the place.
Federal waivers. Yeah. And that might be an out for Gavin to say, well, I wanted single-payer, but those dang guys in Washington. But still, you got to work with them. They have a lot of money, and you got to figure out how to get it for the state.
Melody, what's the realistic probability of seeing any kind of single payer legislation? Is that going to come in right away, or just is Rendon going to say no way?
I mean, you've seen this in the legislature. Essentially, the Senate passes a half cooked bill that said, "We'd like this," and no details, and sends it over to the Assembly. The Assembly says, yeah, we're going to need some details. And so,
how much it's going to cost.
And, it became such a hot button issue in the Capitol for months. You couldn't walk anywhere without the nurses union protesting outside Speaker Rendon's office. I mean, it was a hot mess in the Capitol, dividing, you know, whether or not you can move a bill that has no details just so you can keep working on it. I mean, there's no deadlines in the legislature. They're all pretend deadlines. There's a waiver to every deadline in there. And so it was really kind of kick the can. We want you to come up with the plan. But I don't see this becoming, it's certainly not going to be something that could be cooked in a session. Like this, it's just not going to happen. And even in talking to lawmakers, I mean, there's no plan for the funding. There's no overall picture of how you can get this done in this state, other than a commitment that this is where they want to head.
And Newsom backed off it when he was in the editorial board, John.
Yeah, he did a bit. And by the way, Melody, what do you think the over-under is on the length of his State of the State speech?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Jerry's last report had like 12 minutes.
And, well, he actually, Gavin Newsom, when he was mayor, actually, I believe it was 8 hours, he had a State of the City address.
The good news, though, it was all on YouTube, on so video. You could miss it.
But my editorial
Not
writer.
Another night.
Marshall killed off editorial writer, watched every minute of it.
In my interview with him right before the primaries, I said, can you promise your State of the State will not be 7.5 hours? And I did get him to promise that. So
it'll only be 6.5. Yeah.
We did an over-under last night when Jerry Brown and Kamala Harris introduced Newsom at his final campaign rally here in San Francisco. And we set the over-under on how long Jerry's introduction would be at 4 minutes. He clocked in at 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
Oh, wow. Good guess.
Yes, and he did mention Newsom a couple of times during the intro, which was also a point of contention. Anything else we should know about our state state representatives, who our next representatives going to be. It was largely these are folks who it was, it's going to be almost all Democrats, although we may have a nonpartisan statewide constitutional officer as our insurance commissioner, correct?
Correct. Yes,
you can see the excitement in Melody's. Yes, Melody's
looking forward to covering these state. Yes. Steve Poizner, former Republican candidate for governor, former Republican state legislator.
Candidate. He lost.
Candidate for governor and former, but he was a former assemblyman.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, wasn't he?
Poizner's never been. He ran.
Oh, that's right. He ran.
He ran for Redwood City Assembly seat, but lost.
My bad. But he was the state insurance commissioner once before. And, we have breaking news on the podcast. The Oakland mayoral race has been called for Libby Schaaf, which is really isn't breaking news because it was predicted.
What's breaking news is that Oakland finally got enough results in for us to be able to say that.
1:15
a.m. Thank you, Oakland.
So, Melody, what does that mean that Poizner is the state insurance commissioner? Should we care about
that? Oh, yes. So much news comes out of his office. I deal with it all the time.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, no. I don't know. I think of all the offices, this isn't the one that you're going to say this is a deal breaker. I think it's, an interesting defeat. And maybe that kind of, certainly there's a guy at home right now who's not feeling so good. But I don't know that this is an office that you can say, like, this is what we're going to hang our hat on and say that this is a movement. I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean, this is a trend.
The one thing it does say is that at least somebody's won. Now, Poizner's a little different. He'd already held the office. People knew him as a Republican. Plus, he has more money than God and spent some of it in there, which isn't the normal way it is for a...
Not a lot of guys with that kind of profile.
For an independent candidate. Yeah. But still... First ever independent candidate to win a statewide office. That means something, especially since Republicans are now the third party in California behind the Democrats and the independents.
It really does show how damaged the Republican brand is in California, that the only way to win as a Republican, if you are a Republican, is to disassociate yourself.
To renounce your Republicanism.
To rip that R off your chest. And you still have a close race.
I mean, that's clearly true, but I look at the maps that we have online of the propositions, and anyone who lives in the coastal area thinks they know California, and if you've not been to the Central Valley or far northern California, they do not agree with the people on the coast, and every single proposition breaks down this way. So, I mean, I think the problem for the Republicans is there aren't very many effective ones or good ones in the state right now. If they could get some really compelling candidates who are not, the far right but more centrist, maybe you're not gonna break through San Francisco, but San Luis Obispo went with them a few times. I mean, it's not as black and white as we want it to be. Outside of the coastal urban areas, the state is very different.
Yeah, but the numbers aren't there.
I mean, but when we all can't live in San Francisco anymore, they're gonna move out there, and they already are. They have been. Not that many.
No, not that many. But that's also making those areas more liberal or more moderate, which, puts a Jeff Denham in, in the Central Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley, I've been corrected online, is being in danger because his constituents are much more moderate. They're Bay Area expats, which he made sort of the central theme of his campaign. Anything else we should know at the state level for our readers?
Yeah, tomorrow? Just the one thing is that the proposition shows that
we have to
money still talks. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of money that was put into these prop races, for and against, was just absolutely amazing. And typically, the ones who put the most money in won.
We have two props we should probably talk about. One is the gas tax. So we have not called that yet.
We did right before we came in here that it went down to defeat. So we will keep the gas tax.
Yes. The bad news is you will be paying 12 cents a gallon. You continue to pay 12 cents a gallon. The good news is we'll have $5 billion a year to repair our roads, allegedly. What does that tell us? What does that mean? That Californians did that? Is that purely because it was the anti-gas tax measure, did not measure, mention the words gas or tax on the ballot proposition.
Yeah, they got a little help from Javier Becerra, the Attorney General, with the title and summary, which when we quizzed him about it in the editorial board, he said, well, I only had 200 words to work with. I said, I think repeals gas tax would have taken three of those words, Javier. But I think also there was so much money, you know, to your point, John, that basically the most money won in most of these initiatives. There was, you know, tens of million. I think, what was 40-something million dollars opposed?
46,
is that right, Melanie?
46.
Yeah.
Well, just look at the dialysis measure. For one thing, what the heck was it doing on the ballot in the first place? And the second thing is, there was more money put into that race than any other proposition California's ever seen. Mm-hmm.
And do we think there's going to be any backlash to this year? We were voting on dialysis. We were voting on chickens and cages. Is there going to be voter backlash to that stuff? Like, why the hell are we voting on
this
stuff?
Don't forget daylight savings.
And daylight savings.
Oh, yeah, what happened with daylight savings?
It won big.
Yeah, but now the legislature is going to have to decide. So we'll probably have another measure where the legislature punts that decision back to us.
And then Congress has to give them permission. Well, you think anything's going to get done in Congress on that?
Bringing up the question, what was this doing on the ballot in the first place?
But do we think that anyone's going to push back on that? Or is this just
I feel like this has been a trend for years, and it just keeps happening. So now,
if it's up to my dad, I mean, his question for all of these was calling me and saying, why is this on the ballot? I mean, on each of them. And I do think that there will be some backlash when people start seeing that, you know, that people want to vote no if they think that this isn't something that should be coming before them. And I think on daylight savings time is one of the examples where you're voting on something that's not going to actually happen. Like, I mean, it's like the step in a process that's, I actually was very surprised that Jerry Brown even allowed that on. I really didn't think he'd sign that.
Yeah, and that's frustrating to voters. That feeds into the cynicism about politics and why any of this matters. Speaking of things that matter and don't matter, we Californians also seem to have rejected an expansion of rent control. What, you know, in this state where everything is so unaffordable, where rents are skyrocketing, people are paying, you know, a third of California renters are paying a half of their income on rent. What does that tell us? Why did we reject that?
I think that's another case of money. I mean, look at the amount of money that was spent to kill this and the groups that were involved. I mean, the group that formed in order to take this measure down, they went to the groups that were going to be able to get people on the ground. They had NAACP, they had so many groups throughout the state working this measure, saying that this is going to hurt renters. And I think there was a lot of message confusion in whether or not, you know, what are you voting for and whether or not as a renter you are going to be helped or hurt by this. And I think that was what ultimately that confusion was what killed this.
Well, and as a single family homeowner, are you, if you wanted to leave and rent your house, are you going to be subject to it too? I think people are very paranoid about how things are going to affect them. And that was a confusing measure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you don't know what a city's going to do. Mm-hmm. You're essentially opening the door and saying you're going to leave it to each city. And maybe that's a judgment of what voters feel like their local officials would do with expanded rent control.
I was surprised, though, that San Francisco and the Bay Area voted that down in bigger numbers than the rest of California. You would think it'd be the opposite.
Absolutely.
Why was that?
I agree with you, Heather. I think that was the big surprise. And I will say, you know, full disclosure, our editorial board opposed Prop 10 for a number of reasons. But I thought the anti-Prop 10 campaign, to your point, Melody, was almost disingenuous, because if you listen to their commercials, it sounded like they were on the rent control side.
Right.
Like, this does nothing to help seniors, you know.
Right.
But again, who was on the other side? In California, if you don't have money to get on television, you don't exist. And they didn't have the money to get on and come out against those sort of ads. So they just got pummeled.
Yeah, they didn't have a good constituency. I think the SEIU had some money behind it, and that's about it. But the labor in general was not behind it. They weren't able to tap into deep pockets other than the
construction Weinstein guys were against it.
Yeah, yeah.
And this won't go away. I mean, this will come up in a bill in January. This will be in the legislature all year, and then probably back in the next round for the next ballot.
In fact, our governor-elect was an outlier among Democrats in opposing this. he said that he would talk about it in the legislature. Do you see that happening?
I think that's a bill January 1st in the legislature, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. I mean, David Chu has been very involved in this, and I can see him taking a bill up and trying to shepherd this through. And, you know, that's the one that gets people bussed in by the thousands, like, for these hearings, and, you know, it fills the hallways. And so it's very contentious. And so I definitely think this will be something that comes up January 1st.
Does it get through the legislature, you think, or not?
Are the
mods kind of like stop this
I don't
one?
Even think it's the mods. I think you've seen in San Francisco where it was voted down. Like, I don't think that there's a clear enough road for what it is going to do. And so maybe it's taking on certain parts of Costa-Hawkins versus it just being opening the door entirely. But I feel like there would have to be some sort of deal and it reached in order for this to actually move forward, and it would not be anywhere close to what was on the ballot today.
Just looking at the numbers today, there's no percentage for a Democrat to jump in and be in charge of this again. It just isn't going to be helpful.
Right. And in the example of like why did this fail so miserably in San Francisco, you know, I called the PPIC voters like that had contributed and asked them that question. And one of the things they were saying is essentially, you know, we have rent control and it's not helping me. And so I think that that's sort of the argument that they'll have to get past as well.
All right. I think we're all out of beer right now, so it's probably time to end
this
podcast.
I vote for more beer.
Tape rolling. And another thing.
We should do all the podcasts like this. We should do some editorial boards like this.
Who says we don't?
Oh, now we're getting into the deep secrets of the Chronicle. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Melody Gutierrez. Thank you, Heather Knight. Thank you, John Diaz. Thank you, John Wilderman. Thank you, Joe Garofoli. Thank you, Audrey Cooper. And thank you, Chronicle Managing Editor for Digital, Fernando Diaz, on your final podcast that you're recording. We are going to miss you. We are going to miss you so much. Whether you voted or not, it's all political. I'd like to thank Professor George Lakoff for being on today's It's All Political, and I'd like to thank Fernando Diaz for producing this episode. And as George Lakoff can tell you, no matter if you're breaking down metaphors or building up messaging frames, you know, it's all political.